Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. It's a new year. Happy 2017, everybody. There's a new president about to be sworn in, and right now we're spending a whole lot of time trying to predict what's going to happen. What will the new administration do? What will become of the Affordable Care Act? And more broadly speaking, what will be the big global issues, the trends, the crises that will move us? Are we going to discover new breakthrough treatments for cancer? What new gadgets are we all going to be using? But let's face it, while we're maybe in hyper-future mode right now, we do this prediction thing all the time.
So we have certainly fetishized the future. And if you go back throughout history, every time that humankind has been on the precipice of a brand new technology, we become obsessed with the future.
That's futurist and author Amy Webb. And yes, futurist is an actual job title for people who make a science of figuring out what might happen next. The new technology she was just talking about is artificial intelligence. And she says that has given all of us the future jitters. Like, we know that our lives are changing in a big way. We just don't know how yet. And she says trying to predict the future is not about writing trippy sci-fi narratives. It's mundane and often rather tedious work of crunching data and looking at what's happening right now.
The secret truth of what futurism is that we have one foot firmly planted in the present. Our research, our evidence, what we use to model out the future comes from today. We make adjustments as we go forward, as we think about the implications for the future, because all of us who are futurists have one goal in mind, and that goal is to create a preferred future, because we believe that the future isn't predestined.
We're going to talk more with Amy Webb later on, but let's take her advice and look at some of the things around us right now, signs of things to come, and see what clues they contain for our future. We're going to start with climate change. In addition to tracking temperatures and ocean temperatures, scientists have been looking at different markers like sea level rise, shrinking ice sheets, storms, droughts, for years to gauge how climate change will affect our lives in years and decades to come. Of course, the Earth has warmed and cooled before. Glaciers have formed, they've melted repeatedly, and that has also affected sea levels. Our science reporter Irina Zhorov now takes us on a kayak trip to a New Jersey marsh where signs of such past sea level change are providing important clues in terms of what's in store as the oceans continue to rise.
On an unseasonably warm winter day, I drive to a pristine corner of southern New Jersey, near Egg Harbor City, down an unpaved puddle-pocked road that dead-ends in water.
This area is unique in New Jersey and even for the east coast of the U.S., because there are very few people living in the watershed.
Ken Abel, a professor at Rutgers University, greets me there.
As a result of that, the water is very clean. There's lots of undisturbed habitat.
This is not urban blight and industrial pollution New Jersey. It's pristine, marshy, beautiful New Jersey. As the wind howls, Abel hands out paddles to me and Jennifer Walker, a Rutgers graduate student studying sea level rise.
You have a color preference?
And we each get in a kayak. We paddle on Jimmy's Creek out onto the Mullica River, where the wind turns the water choppy and the steering wobbly. And then we duck again into a smaller, more protected stream called Big Creek. As we paddle, the tide falls. I've rigged the microphone on the front of my kayak like a flag of sorts, and it picks up Abel's observations as he paddles next to me.
From about here up, we should start seeing some pieces of wood. The tide's still a little bit high yet, but...
This is why we came here, to see some dead trees.
Oh yeah, I saw a stump right there. There's another one.
I just hit one.
As we're paddling along, Abel keeps pointing out these old stumps just barely under the surface of the water.
More over there. I'll just get some more. There's some more there. There's more there. Now I can't put my... Oh, there's a nice one. See that one?
And as the tide falls further and further, it becomes clear that
another
world is emerging. A past one, when a forest stood right where we're paddling in our kayaks. Rising seas drown these trees. Walker, the grad student, says they're called ghost forests.
They're kind of these two areas of ghost forests.
One is where we're paddling, completely submerged stumps where the marsh has already taken over. And then?
On the shoreline, you have your marshes and then these areas of standing dead trees, Atlantic white cedars.
Up ahead, where the water hits the shore, stands a line of bare gray tree trunks. The marsh is in the process of claiming these drowned but still standing trees.
They kind of extend back until you reach the border of the living forest.
Walker's job is to figure out the history of the marsh going back about 5,000 years, when it formed. She wants to know when the trees died and how that relates to historic sea levels. Seas rise when the climate warms and glaciers melt. The process of sea level rise and fall has happened repeatedly in the past. What may be unusual now is the rate of change. Sped up by human-caused climate change, everything seems to be happening very fast. So scientists are scrambling to better understand the complex relationship between climate and sea levels.
Since, you know, we want to figure out what kind of sea level rise we could see in the future, we need to see how sea level responds to climate. So if you have a better understanding of that in the past, we can better predict that for the future.
We're trying to see, right, okay, if we have an understanding of what temperature has done, what does sea level do?
That's Walker's advisor, Ben Horton. He says the idea is to paint a very clear picture of what happened in New Jersey, correlate that with research in other regions, and eventually clarify what we can expect to see around the world as the Earth warms. If temperature and sea level rise together in a predictable fashion, say for each degree the temperature goes up, the sea level rises by X millimeters, well, that's one thing. But if sea levels begin to rise much more dramatically at a certain threshold, that'll be much harder to plan for.
Sea level is a very sort of accurate barometer of climate change.
This part of New Jersey is an ideal place to study these processes. Because there hasn't been much development here, the researchers can see how nature works with limited human interference. But Virginia Institute of Marine Science researcher Matt Kirwan says it's happening everywhere.
Nobody has summarized the effect of sea level rise on a ghost forest formation across the United States or across the Atlantic United States. But it's very clear that this process is occurring in most Atlantic coast estuaries.
Kirwan has been studying marsh formation on an island off the coast of Virginia.
Every storm or high water event that goes through, we see a few more trees that die. And usually new trees don't get established once the adult trees have died. Instead, the marsh just moves a little further inland.
Kirwan says the rate of forest loss is accelerating. At his site, trees have been dying faster and faster every decade since the 1940s. He attributes that to the speed up of sea level rise.
For people that live close to the coast, this is a depressing event. You're talking about land that people have lived on, maybe their families have lived on it for several generations, that was dry, usable farmland when their grandparents were alive. So the big story here is that dry land is being converted to wetlands.
This isn't theoretical for him. The marsh has swallowed up his grandparents' land in Maryland.
They grew strawberries until the 1940s, and now that land is flooded twice a day.
Grad student Jennifer Walker also has a personal connection to her study area. Back on land in New Jersey, we drive to a cut of road several miles from the creek.
I grew up near this area, close to the coast, going to the shore. So I feel more connected to the issue of sea level rise in particular.
Behind where we park stretches a swampy inlet, fallen logs crisscrossing the bottom. In front of us, Abel, the Rutgers professor, points to a hem of standing ghost forest, and then the live trees.
So we're right in the middle of the process here, you know. Those, how old are those that aren't standing? How old are those that are dead and standing? And then how about the live ones that are standing as well? So.
Here we have this nice transition, right live to dead. You should be able to match up, you know, the cores without too much trouble.
Walker marches into the ghost forest in her waders to take cores from the dead trees. She'll use the cores to date the trees.
You know, we've had sea level rising for a long period of time, so why is it important now? But we're seeing the fastest rates of sea level rise in 3,000 years right now. You know, everything could shift backwards from the coast, except that you run into things like agriculture or, you know, any kind of human development.
Right behind where she works stands a house, something else the swamp could soon swallow.
That's Irina Zhorov reporting from the marshes of New Jersey. We're talking about signs of things to come on today's show and how we interpret those signs to try and figure out what might happen next. Let's stick with climate change. The first scientist to call for a global study of man's impact on climate was Alexander von Humboldt, and this was in 1829. Humboldt saw the signs of human impact on the planet during his travels and explorations. Andrea Wolf describes this in her new book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And she told me that he was the first to understand the forces that shape climate and to see nature as a complex system.
Yes, so he is really the first to describe nature as a web of life, as an interconnected whole. He describes Earth as a living organism. And what's extraordinary about that is when we look at what other scientists at that time or just before his time, how they were thinking about nature. They were seeing nature very much as a much more kind of mechanical system, not as a living organism. And because he sees nature as a web of life or as a tapestry or something like that, he also sees that when we pull one thread, that this whole thing might unravel. So he's then the first to talk about harmful human-induced climate change already in 1800.
And what did people think of that idea? Was that just completely foreign to them? I mean, I think the sense was more we need to subdue and control nature at that time.
Yeah, at that time, the big buzzword was really improvement. So man was improving on nature. The ideal, the beauty ideal in nature was neat fields and straight lines of vegetables and straight lines of trees and orchards. So this idea that we had to protect nature, or that we were actually, that humankind was destroying nature, was very much a new idea. And it didn't really take off very much during Humboldt's time. And this is one of the reasons why in The Invention of Nature, I'm not just talking about Humboldt, but I'm also talking about the people who he influenced, who took some of his ideas and really thought them through. So, for example, John Muir, the father of the national parks, was very much influenced by Humboldt. His ecological foundation comes from reading Humboldt's books. And amazingly, John Muir's Humboldt books still exist in an archive in California. And when you read them, you can see how Muir underlined everything that Humboldt wrote about deforestation, for example, or the destructive force of agriculture.
What were some of the signs, some of the things Humboldt was observing that caused this concern in him? Describe some of that.
So a lot of the concern comes from his travels through South America. So what he's seeing in South America is, for example, lots of plantations, lots of monoculture, and he sees how the plantation owners have felled the forest to make way for their fields, how then the deforestation has caused things like soil erosion. So seeing this destruction, he is the very first to describe the fundamental functions of the forest for the ecosystem. So he talks about the tree's ability to store water, for example, or to protect against soil erosion. At the Venezuelan coast, he sees how unchecked pearl fishing, for example, has completely destroyed the oyster stocks. at the high plateau of Mexico City. He sees how the local irrigation system has left the valleys below barren. And as he paddles along the Orinoco, he sees in a mission how the how missionaries collect turtle eggs, which they use to harvest oil for their lamps, and how, because they collect so many turtle eggs, how the next generation of turtles kind of get less and less and less. So he sees everything as this kind of ecological chain reaction.
Given Humboldt's early concern with where our planet was going, how humans were altering our environment, how could you see him working today, or where do you see his voice echo, so to speak?
I would imagine that he'd be pretty shocked to see what's going on, because he already warned of harmful human-induced climate change more than 200 years ago. He was at moments very, very pessimistic. There's a diary entry from 1801 when he's in Latin America where he talks about a future, a possible future where humankind might travel to distant planets, and that we then might take our lethal mixture of greed and arrogance and ignorance with us, and we'll destroy and kind of turn these planets as barren and as ravaged as we've already done with Earth. So when I look at that, I assume that he would be rather unhappy about what's happening today in the world.
Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrea Wolf is a historian and writer. Her new book is The Invention of Nature. When it comes to our own bodies, our health, there are often many signs that something isn't right. We can notice this if we just pay attention. Our next story is about an artist who dismissed some very serious warning signs of illness. Philadelphia rapper Leslie Pridgen, also known as Freeway, was in his early 20s when he joined Jay-Z's Rockefeller label.
The thing that I love about music and hip-hop and rap is it's a way for me to express how I feel and what I go through in my life. We still hustle till the sun come up, crack a 40 when the sun go down, it's a cold winter, y'all better bundle up. You know, I've seen my share of violence, drug dealing, you know, I've been through it all.
He's stocky, his full face is framed by what's become known as a Philly beard. It's a bushy growth of hair from one ear to the other with a thin mustache. Freeway has toured the world, he's performed for tens of thousands of fans. His career had ups and downs, and along the way, he developed high blood pressure and diabetes. He says he took his health problems seriously at first, he changed his diet and his lifestyle, but then over time, he let things slip.
It was something that I wasn't aware of was going on, but it was creeping up on me. And, you know, it was building up and toxins was building up, and so I couldn't take it no more.
For our series Patient Files, Your Stories of Illness, Healing, and Coping, Freeway told us all of this came to a head during a huge outdoor concert in September of 2015.
Before I perform, I always get nervous. You know, it's just part of being an artist, but I never felt how I felt that day. We had a big concert in Philadelphia, Made in America. I would perform with Fabulous. Yeah, it's a big show, probably like 80,000 people. And like right before I was getting ready to go on stage and perform, it's like I got an anxiety attack. I'm looking out into the crowd. I was so scared. I felt like I was going to pass out. I felt like I couldn't do it. It was real hot outside. I just felt weak. So I told them like right before we was going on stage, I'm not going to be able to do it. And they was like, yo, you gotta do it. Everybody's waiting for you to come out. So I pushed through it. And by the grace of God, I got through it. But I really felt crazy. Like I couldn't, it was hard for me to walk back to the car. That's how bad it was. So a little while after that, my primary physician called me and told me I need to get to the hospital, because my electrolytes is off, my kidney functions is low. The first thing I did, me being Muslim, is I went to the masjid. I pray, I ask God to help me deal with whatever the situation is. And I went to the hospital, and that's when I was diagnosed with kidney failure. They cut my chest open, put a permacath in my chest. The next day I was doing dialysis. And I've been doing dialysis 4 hours a day, 3 times a week since then.
Was after dialysis. About to walk in. Still chilly out here. Once I get in here, sit my stuff down, get on the scale, get weighed, and then get ready to get hooked up to the machine. That's the routine. Sheesh. And I always stop in the bathroom first because I'm on the machine for 4 hours and I would hate to have to stop my treatment just to go to the bathroom. I've been on dialysis for like a year and a couple months, and that only happened one time. So I try my best not to let that happen. About to stick this BA needle. I can't even look no more. Oh, but I didn't feel it. I must have put a lot. I put the right amount of cream on.
Yeah.
Now they taping me up after they insert the needle. Now here comes the second needle. I felt that one just a tiny bit, but not too much.
In my chair, there's a recliner. My feet goes up, and I sit back and relax, and I'll be chilling.
It's almost 9:05. Got like another hour and a half left. I was on YouTube watching old rap videos. I was watching videos from Naughty by Nature, Tupac, the Youngsters.
It's very draining, like getting your blood drained out of your body and pumped back in. It's a lot of people that can't even do nothing the rest of the day. I knew people that was in dialysis. My uncle, my mother's brother, just received a transplant probably 2 years before that. But we didn't discuss it. I feel as though it's not talked about very much because it's something that a lot of people are ashamed of. Like, you know, it's a disease, you know, and ain't nobody running around talking about I got a disease and I'm sick. And you'd be surprised when I came out with my story. You'd be surprised how many people came to me like, oh my God, my father, me, my cousin, my sister, it's kidney failure. I have a cousin named Shandia. I had a cousin named Shandia. She passed away from kidney disease. It's this guy named Fife from Tribe Called Quest, which was a huge group when I was growing up. All through the years, my mic has been my best friend. I know some brothers wonder, can Fife really kick it? Some even want to diss me. But why sweat it? I'm all into my music. He just passed away. There's countless artists that have high blood pressure and diabetes. You know, this is normal in the African-American community. It's really serious. It's really affecting us. My kidneys fell, but I ain't lay down. Shots whizzed past my head, and I ain't stay down. My focus got my click together. I don't actually write. I get the beat, and I create. I got my together. I got some to tell ya. I suffer kidney failure. Yeah, them bad kidneys almost took me out of here. It's not like I got a whole song about kidney failure. I just touch bases in it, like, you know.
Wasted. I can breathe. I'm breathing. I'm living, I'm still breathing.
That's right.
Yeah, my kidney's bad, but I'm still breathing.
Well, my understanding is you can live on dialysis for years, you know, but once you get a kidney, it doubles your life expectancy.
That's right. Oh, by the way, I'm on the list. That new kidney on the way.
Yeah, I'm waiting, I'm on the list. They could call me anytime. It changed me. It just matured me a lot. You know, it really made me appreciate life and appreciate the blessing of life that God's given me and the opportunity to keep being here and keep pushing.
That's hip-hop artist Leslie Pridgen, better known as Freeway. The Pulse's Alana Gordon produced this piece. Freeway is one of more than 100,000 people in the U.S. who are on the organ transplant list. Most of them are waiting for kidneys. He says while he's waiting, he's touring, he's making music, and he's staying strong. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to move on now from the patient side of this story to a physician's perspective. Charles Modlin is a transplant surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. He also directs the Minority Men's Health Center there. He says a lot of his patients are African Americans, and the fact that kidney disease is so prevalent in this community is a sign that physicians could do a lot better when it comes to prevention. So as a transplant surgeon, you see people when they are really sick. What do they tell you about kind of how the disease progressed for them? Can they kind of believe that they are at this point now?
Sure. You know, a lot of people are diagnosed with significant chronic kidney disease and kidney failure. Many of these individuals, they will tell you that they did not even know that they had or suffered from kidney disease. Many people didn't even know that they had diabetes or hypertension or both. Many individuals, they've known that they've been afflicted with hypertension or diabetes, but they've been really kind of negligent in terms of taking care of it, maybe following through to see their primary care doctors, their diabetes doctors. A lot of times it's because of delayed presentation of disease. The hypertension or diabetes is not diagnosed until, you know, later stages, at which point the kidney disease has already set in, taken place. You know, it's important to note that if we can diagnose in early stages diabetes and or hypertension, we can actually, in many situations, prevent the onset of kidney disease.
Now, part of your work is to erase health care disparities. What do you think has to happen to tackle some of these issues here?
We as healthcare providers need to admit that these healthcare disparities exist. We need to educate ourselves about the disparities that afflict individuals, especially minorities and underserved individuals. But then I think a lot of the solution rests in terms of educating the community in terms of how better to take care of themselves, how better the importance of undergoing routine preventative health screenings for the early detection of not only kidney disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, cancers, a number of other conditions. So we need to improve the health literacy of the community. We need to also create opportunities, more access opportunities for individuals to undergo the screenings. But it's not just about screening. It's about establishing a patient-centered medical home for subsequent follow-up and, you know, so there are a number of things that we need to do. A lot of it rests on education, promoting access, educating other healthcare providers about the phenomenon of healthcare disparities. More research needs to be done in terms of trying to figure out the causes, you know, the pathogenesis of health disparities. Family members need to talk with one another about the diseases, the medical conditions that are prevalent in their family situations. So a number of situations needs to occur, you know, and again, that's why we established our Minority Men's Health Center at Cleveland Clinic to address health disparities specifically afflicting disproportionately African-American men and other underserved men as well.
Dr. Modlin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Charles Modlin is a urologist and transplant surgeon, and he directs the Minority Men's Health Center at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. Coming up, we'll meet a man with brain implants that let him feel things he's not actually touching, and there's a whole range of sensations.
There's one that's really weird and hard to describe. I just call it Spidey Sense.
Cutting-edge research that's changing the field of prosthetics. That's next on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, providing comprehensive cancer care with treatment options like intraoperative radiation therapy that delivers radiation during surgery to help reduce treatment time and get patients back to their lives faster. At Cancer Treatment Centers of America, they treat every stage of cancer. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America, care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. We're talking about signs of things to come on today's show, and I always try to make predictions around the new year, but I'm terrible at it. I've predicted that people would get tired of tracking themselves on runs and with their steps. I was wrong, and guess who just got a Fitbit for Christmas? I'm, what, about 5 years late to that party? I've also forecast that people would leave social media in droves. That didn't really happen. And let's face it, when most of us predict stuff, we're just guessing, but there are people who have made it a serious science to figure out how our lives will change in the next years and decades. They're called futurists. Amy Webb is one of them, and I asked her exactly what that means.
So a futurist is somebody who uses some kind of methodology and collects data and evidence from the present and models it out in order to understand the probable, plausible, and possible scenarios for the future.
Can you give me an example of something you've done recently, a model like that, or something you were trying to predict?
Sure. I would, at the moment, though, say that, just a quick clarification, so futurists don't make predictions. A prediction would, I think, lead folks to believe that there is only one likely outcome. And that's usually why when you see those lists of predictions, they're almost always wrong. For me to model out what I see the future of something, you know, being, there's usually not a singular answer because the process isn't linear. But recently, so I've been modeling out the future of artificial intelligence as it relates to lots of different fields and disciplines. When we talk about the future of AI, most often the conversation goes in one of two directions, either robots are taking our jobs, or robots will soon take our jobs, or AI will become weaponized and kill us all. And the real future of AI isn't just those two extremes, or one of the two extremes, but rather much more sophisticated and detailed stories that fall between. So as I've been modeling AI as it relates to things like medicine and public health and city infrastructure and so forth and so on, one of the critical areas of research that folks should be looking into has to do with bias in data sets. Artificially intelligent systems require data sets. One of the big challenges is in figuring out in advance whether or not that data set itself is biased. And that may seem strange. We don't often think of data itself being biased, but the data didn't just show up. Humans put it together. And humans bring with us into every project and thing that we do our own worldviews and our own perspectives.
So the future sounds pretty complicated, right? Webb goes through several steps in modeling future possibilities. And one big part of her process is to look for what she calls unusual suspects at the fringe. People talking about technology in online forums, hackers trying things out in DIY basement labs.
I'm really interested in machine learning algorithms and recognition algorithms. So right now, some very, very early research has shown that computers are able to watch videos and predict what humans are likely to do next. And it's fascinating. We are training computers to understand our behavior and to essentially predict what humans might do next. The long-term implications of this are far-reaching. They are really interesting to think about. They are also really terrifying to think about. So that's one area of research from the fringe that I think is fascinating. I think that blockchain, which is the underlying platform for the digital currency Bitcoin, I don't know that I would categorize blockchain as strictly fringe anymore, but I'm very, very interested to see how the blockchain will pretty dramatically change lots of different industries, from banking to mortgages to the legal industry. It will really dramatically change how they all work and who and the people that work there. And I'm also really fascinated by the emergence of different kinds of robots. So there are these really interesting soft, there's a whole field of soft robotics. These are flexible robots. I've seen one that essentially looks and feels like an octopus that can go underwater and is flexible, just like an octopus is flexible. But also nanobots, which are tiny, and smart dust, which is even smaller, that have the ability to deliver personalized medicine. Smart dust can take photos in the air as it is suspended. So I'm watching those technologies as they start to sort of evolve.
So I guess instead of using a selfie stick, we could all be using smart dust in the future. Just go, and then make your best duck lips. Amy Webb is a futurist. Her new book is The Signals Are Talking: Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about signs of things to come on our show today. And our next story is about signs of hope for people who are paralyzed or have lost an arm or a leg. I'm sure you remember actor Christopher Reeve of Superman fame, right? He was in a wheelchair for the last almost 10 years of his life after a riding accident. He was paralyzed from the neck down. He needed a ventilator. But until his death in 2004, he was a tireless advocate for aggressive research into reversing spinal cord damage. And this is not something people thought was realistic at that time, but Reeve never accepted his condition as final. There's even a Super Bowl commercial from the year 2000. It forecast a bright future, and it featured Reeve.
Tonight we celebrate a remarkable breakthrough in spinal cord injuries,
made possible by countless researchers
and contributors.
And to present this award, we have some very special guests.
And here the camera pans to a pair of feet walking slowly toward the stage. And then we see Christopher Reeve, Superman, walking once again. This didn't happen for Reeve, but he was right in envisioning major leaps and innovation in this area. For example, scientists are already able to hook people up to robotic limbs that they can move with their minds. But there's still a big problem to solve. People controlling the robotic arm don't get any sensory feedback. It's difficult to know how hard to grip an object or where your prosthetic hand is if you can't actually feel anything with it. Reporter Liz Reed explains how scientists are not only sending information from the brain to the robotic limbs, but also from the limbs back to the brain.
In 2004, Nathan Copeland, who was 18 at the time, was driving home in the rain and lost control of his car.
I was almost home, too. I was like 2 miles from home.
He suffered a spinal cord injury and is now paralyzed from the neck down. He has an electronic wheelchair that he operates with the limited mobility in his arms, but he doesn't feed or dress himself. His favorite hobbies are things he can do from his chair: video games, anime, and the role-playing card game Magic the Gathering. I first met Copeland in Pittsburgh at a showcase for cutting-edge scientific research called the White House Frontiers Conference. He was there to demonstrate a robotic arm developed at the University of Pittsburgh. A few times a week for the past year and a half, Copeland has made the hour-long trip from his home in rural southwestern Pennsylvania to participate in research that probably won't ever change his own life.
But eventually, down the road, it's really going to help all kinds of people. It'll really improve their lives, even something as simple as being able to feed yourself can really make a life better.
Surgeons placed 4 implants in Copeland's brain that send signals to his brain cells. Each implant is about 1 inch square with 100 tiny hairs sunk into his brain. 2 devices sit in the part of the brain that controls movement, and 2 are in the section that processes sensation. They're hard to see through his thick brown hair, but two metal bolts protrude out of Copeland's head. Each time he comes to the bioengineering lab in Pittsburgh, researchers attach his brain to the robotic arm by screwing thick gray cables onto the bolts in his head. These implants make Copeland one of the first humans ever to feel something he's not actually touching.
There's about four or five different sensations that I can feel. So the most common is like a pressure or a tingling. Sometimes it's like warm. There's one that's really weird and hard to describe. I just call it Spidey sense.
Think about this. He hasn't been able to use his arms or legs for over a decade, but now he can once again feel the touch of another person. So we shook hands. He had a strong grip, but he had kind of toned it down. And then we gave each other a fist bump.
President Obama spoke at the Frontiers Conference shortly after he and Nathan met.
That's what science does. That's what American innovation can do. And imagine the breakthroughs that are around the corner. Imagine what's possible for Nathan if we keep on pushing the boundaries.
There are still major hurdles to jump over before this technology can go into clinical trials. The most obvious one is those large, clunky cables sticking out of Copeland's head.
That's not a solution.
That's Pitt biomedical engineer Rob Gaunt.
This is a temporary thing that we need to do this research right now, but that has got to go away. We can't send people home with those things.
Gaunt says ideally this technology would be wireless, and there are several research institutions and private companies all over the world working on the problem.
I think actually there's a lot of optimism that within a couple of years these devices really will achieve that wireless capability. But these are hard problems. These are the types of things that have never been done before in terms of putting wireless devices in the human body.
Gaunt says the team could be as much as 10 years away from clinical trials. His boss, Michael Boninger, looks even further ahead.
So do I think we'll have full recovery in a in 100 years? The answer is yes. I completely believe that. I think that I'm not going to be the person who's working on that, but I'm hoping that they'll build off of what we've done here at the University of Pittsburgh.
Boninger envisions these bioengineering advances being used in concert with biological advances in the field of stem cell research. And he says that Luke Skywalker-type hand from The Empire Strikes Back is likely to one day be not science fiction, but just science. For The Pulse, I'm Liz Reed.
Liz is a reporter with our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're talking about signs of things to come on today's show in medicine, in science, in our environment. And for years now, we've heard that bees are in trouble. Researchers have been observing some scary signs that both wild bees and honeybees are declining and dying in record numbers, which could endanger our food supply. But now scientists are noticing that wild bees are leaving rural areas to take refuge in cities, and they are investigating this migration. Eli Chen reports from St. Louis.
In a community garden full of okra, squash, and hot peppers, biologist Erardo Camilo walks methodically, gripping a butterfly net. He stops and stares at a bee weaving in and out of a patch of tall flowers. He swings the net, and the bee's trapped.
Wow! I have never seen bees in my life. What the hell are you?
The bee is just a little larger than a kidney bean, and it's covered in so much pollen, Camilo doesn't recognize the species. He calls over his graduate student, Paige Muniz.
Take a look. Yeah, when it comes to identifying stuff, I trust her.
That's a bumblebee. Check out all the orange pollen on her. She looks like a little candy corn.
Muniz and Camilo are researchers at St. Louis University. They are collecting wild bees in St. Louis, Chicago, and Detroit to document a trend scientists have noticed in the last few years. The number and the variety of wild bee species are growing in cities.
In cities in general, they tend to have very large bee diversity, especially when compared to suburbs and even compared to surrounding agricultural areas.
This matters because wild bees help our food supply. They move pollen from flower to flower so plants can make fruit. Ed Spivak is the St. Louis Zoo's expert on pollinators. He says wild bees are big producers, but an underrecognized talent.
Many of them are actually far better pollinators for a lot of our crops, and particularly the wild plants we've evolved with, than honeybees are.
Bee researcher Camilo says one reason bees are moving to cities is because they're losing habitat in rural areas. Industrial agriculture has promoted the development of monocultures. That's a practice where farmers plant one crop over a large area.
The expansion of monocultures has resulted in very little land left untouched.
A lot of bees are specialists. The squash bee, for example, prefers the pollen from squash. If an area that used to grow butternut, zucchini, and pumpkins is planted with a single crop, like corn, that forces bees to find food somewhere else.
The less area we have for native plants, the less habitat and the less resources you have for these beautiful, beautiful organisms.
As plant variety fades out in the country, the options are increasing in urban spaces. City residents are building community gardens and introducing more flowering plants, which attracts bees. Within the city of St. Louis, Camilo's team discovered the most variety of wild bees in low-income neighborhoods, where people may not have the time or money to spend on pest control.
You have $20 in your pocket. Are you going to go and buy pesticide or weed killer for your sidewalk or your driveway? No. Your preoccupation is more into putting food on the table than on meeting some aesthetic level that is irrelevant to your life.
North St. Louis has numerous vacant lots. Many of them are full of overgrown weeds.
People would say, oh, it's unkept because you have all these leftover vegetation tossed to the side. Well, bees like that. That provides habitat. It provides refuge.
Recent research supports this. A study led by conservation scientists in Massachusetts reported that mowing your lawn less frequently can boost the number of bees. Camilo and his colleagues are beginning to share that information, along with their own findings, with local residents in St. Louis. He wants to encourage people to change their gardening practices, and he wants to show policymakers that cities can play a critical role in supporting wildlife.
If we're going to be investing in a sustainable city, what does that look like, you know, in terms of food production as well as in terms of pollinators?
So, if we make the effort to feed the bees, it might help us feed ourselves. For The Pulse, I'm Eli Chen.
Eli is a science reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Irina Zhorov. Alex Stern is our intern, Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager our associate producer, and Megan Pinto the executive producer. This week, we say goodbye to our managing editor, Joel Patterson. He's been with us since the beginning of The Pulse, and he helped shape our sound in so many ways. He's leaving the show to work for a digital design firm, and we wish him the best of luck, and we'll miss you, Joel. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, most of us are used to nurses being women, so much so that we're not even sure what to call guys who do this job.
Men in nursing are nurses. I am not a male nurse. I'm a nurse.
How men are faring in this traditionally female domain.
You know, even when I worked OBGYN, I worked obstetrics. I never had a woman say, I don't want him in here. He's a man.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes. And while you're there, leave us a review. That helps other people find The Pulse, too.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.